Hello and welcome to another episode of Cinema Science, where we take a look at topics in popular culture and dissect them from a somewhat scientific perspective. This week, we're going to be taking a long, hard look at vampires, whether there is any scientific basis to vampires, what that might be, maybe who gets it the most accurately in movies, TV, whatever we want to talk about. My name is Nick. My partner in crime, as always, from across the internet is...
Chris.
Chris, good to see you again.
Good to hear you again?
Yes, no, I jacked into your webcam.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I got a leg up in that regard, but... So we're going to start off talking about vampires today. What we like to do is I like to kind of, I don't know, science, and especially in something like this where I don't know how much science applies, I'm curious to see. My general vibe on vampires is a little bit mythological. I understand there's some historical basis for vampires, especially in Eastern European traditions, I know. But in popular culture, my understanding of vampires is pretty much... there's already a vampire, you get bit, and then you drink some of their blood, and boom, you're a vampire. You lose your soul, your body just becomes like a walking, I don't know, dead person.
I mean, yeah, that I'm going to have to really like defer to you on vampire creation, because I hate to break this to you like this in front of everyone, but yeah, vampires aren't real, Nick.
Okay. While I was researching this, I searched specifically on Google, how do you become a vampire? Not to find out how it's done in films. I feel pretty good about my knowledge there. But there are legitimate websites that help you through the entire process.
I didn't realize that.
Yep. You just have to go online and you can become a vampire. It's basically like becoming an ordained minister.
Well, and we all know how easy that is.
It absolutely is. So that is exactly my point. So, Chris, why don't you give me just a quick overview of some of the things that you know about vampires, maybe in historical or scientific terms?
Well, you know, from a history perspective, vampires have existed pretty much throughout all of human history. You can find stories or evidence about vampires across cultures and across centuries. Like they've existed for a very long time in folklore. As far as, I don't want to give anything away, but as far as the science goes for any of that, there are a few theories about where the idea of vampires comes from and why they're so prevalent in human folklore.
Okay.
But there's no definitive theory behind where they come from.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I would kind of like to start off different than we did last week. I think with this one, vampires for the most part throughout movies and TV have a lot of the same characteristics. Obviously the mythology has changed for each person that kind of takes the vampire mythos on, but I think it would be a little bit more boring just to go movie by movie. So we'll highlight some movies as we're talking about the stuff, but I think it'll make more sense just to kind of go through and talk about some of the more popular characteristics of vampires and then see if there's any basis to any of that stuff.
Sure. And I think to start that discussion off a little bit, there's actually two pretty distinct types of like vampire. There is like the folkloric vampire, you know, like the traditional vampire, and then there is like the modern vampire, and they are two different things. They have much different or many different characteristics. And I will say the fictional vampire, or like the more modern vampire, way cooler than the folkloric vampire.
That is true. So when we're talking about fictional vampires versus folkloric vampires, where does Dracula fall on that spectrum?
So he's actually pretty pretty solidly on the fictional side. But I will say that they do borrow a lot of traits from folkloric vampires, like the garlic, the being, you know, garlic fighting them off thing. That's straight from folklore. The being invited into your home, you know, that must be invited to cross the threshold or whatever. That's actually from folklore. But like the fangs or the not liking sunlight thing, that's all modern stuff. That wasn't really historically what a vampire was.
Okay. So we can start by talking about Dracula. Obviously, he's been represented about 45 million times since the book came out. But obviously, Dracula is one character that has a lot of, well, I don't know if I should say a lot of, but at least has some basis in historical fact.
Sure. That all goes back to Vlad Dracul, who was a, he was a pretty horrible human that actually existed, and did some pretty horrendous things to other people.
I think it's pretty safe to say that he impaled some people.
He was known as Vlad the Impaler, and I feel like that that really, says all you need to know about him from a, you know, from a high level perspective.
And I think part of his whole thing, part of the reason that people think he's got some association with the vampire is, I think his, I don't know whether it's true or just part of his mythology, says that he would like drink the blood of his victims or something with his dinner, or like something gnarly like that.
Well, he did a lot of like really crazy stuff. Like, I don't want to dive like super deep into this because you could talk about Vlad the Impaler for hours, but essentially at that time in history, there was a lot of conflict happening essentially constantly. And he was like so brutal and so just desensitized to like human suffering that he would do things like there's a story, again, I don't know how historically accurate it is, but there's a story about him. He didn't like essentially homeless people. He thought they were just lazy. So he did this thing where he had this giant banquet. It was like all the food you could eat, all the wine you could drink. And he invited all the homeless people, and all these homeless people, you know, he's got hundreds of these people in this room, and they're all celebrating. And then he locks the doors and sets the place on fire.
Wow. He
was just an absolute nightmare of a human.
That's a real Walter Frey move.
It's
Walter
not...
Frey, sorry.
He had a stroke for a second.
Yeah, that's a crazy thing to do. But I guess that's kind of the sort of things that kind of, obviously, if you were living during that time, not a great thing. But looking back, those kind of larger-than-life figures do kind of provide a good basis for these sort of fantastical figures in fiction.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So let's look at Dracula, because Dracula, like I said, has been done a million times in popular culture. Obviously, he is the most famous, maybe the most famous monster of all time. And you've mentioned a couple of the things already that kind of define the Draculean vampire. You mentioned the garlic, you mentioned the being invited across the threshold, having their roots in folklore. But I think the interesting thing about Bram Stoker's Dracula, maybe that kind of added on to his mythology, is some of the more like Christian elements of it, right? Is because Bram Stoker's Dracula, those vampires are kind of demonic, right? So the sign of the cross scares them away because they can't be exposed to godly things, if I understand that correctly.
Yeah, that's true. And that actually is also from the folkloric vampire. They did, you know, especially in the Middle Ages, Christianity and Christian belief was like, that was the only belief there was in a lot of places, you know? So, those emblems and those symbols were super important to those people, and they adopted those into their mythology, like, very deeply.
So with that, I think one facet of vampires that's a little bit nebulous as you're talking about some of the different types of vampires, but I think traditionally when somebody becomes a vampire, they're giving up their human form. So they may be walking around in the body of a human, but essentially they've sacrificed their soul to become a vampire. And now the thing that walks around is just a demonic force. So what I need you to explain to me, Chris, is what does science say about ripping the soul from your body and replacing it with an immortal demon spirit?
So this actually might come as a bit of a shock to you and some of our listeners, but science actually has to say not a lot about that.
Well, that's disappointing. I think everybody tuned in to this episode hoping that you would explain that to them.
I hate to disappoint everybody, but that is kind of not where this conversation is headed. What what I will say is that the folkloric vampire tradition, as far as I could tell, never explicitly mentioned immortality as being a thing that vampires had. It was like implied, but nobody ever actually came out and said, "Oh yeah, vampires are immortal." That's kind of the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a super weird thing, because to us, at least to me, a modern vampire, that's like what the whole, that it's, you know, that character pivots on its immortality.
Right. And that's kind of the one thing that you're like, okay, so all this shitty stuff happens to you. Like, you can't go outside during the day. You can never eat Italian food again. You can never do any of this stuff, but you're immortal. So that's like the trade-off.
Right, right. And the, as far as I could tell in researching old-timey vampires, is that it wasn't really something that had the same, I don't know, story arc as modern vampires do.
Sure.
And that might just be because those stories don't just didn't survive, or that, you know, stories back in the olden days just sucked.
That's pretty true. The one thing that I think is interesting that I think you start to introduce, starting with Bram Stoker's Dracula, and then has obviously become a much bigger thing in recent vampire mythology, and you can correct me if this is folkloric as well, but one of the things that is pivotal about the modern vampire mythology is the sort of sexuality of vampires, like the inhuman beauty of vampires, right? They're like these very sensual, sexual creatures. Does that have any basis in folklore?
No, almost all folklore describes vampires as like having a bloaty or a bloated and like purplish appearance. There are stories of them appearing. I think they describe them as looking better than they did when they were alive. Mm-hmm. But most all of them are, they look bloated and like ruddy or purplish. With the modern theory explaining that is that really what they were seeing were just corpses.
Right.
That, you know, when bodies are dead, they start to bloat.
So what do you think that's about then? So like, if you look at, I think one of the best examples for me, at least, that I've seen in popular culture as far as these like sexualized vampires go is Bram Stoker's Dracula that was done by Francis Ford Coppola in the early 90s with Gary Oldman as Dracula. This movie is so sexual that it blows my mind. Like there's like blood ejaculations, essentially. I don't even know if I should be saying that in the podcast. It felt weird to say, but it's a very, very, very sexual movie. Like and I think that's kind of central to a lot of the vampire mythologies you see now, whether it's like modern YA sexualization, like Twilight or any of these movies, vampires are like sexual creatures now. Obviously, like you said, there's no basis necessarily in folklore, but where does that come from? Why does that come
so
out?
There's actually a weird theory about that. And I think we need to separate, like sexuality from beauty for a minute. In the folklore, there wasn't a lot of support for a beautiful vampire, but there actually is some support for a hypersexualized vampire. There's a very interesting theory behind that. And I, you know, talking about origins of vampire folklore in general, there's a few different theories that explain that. One of the theories, and it's my favorite theory, I was going to save it for last, but I love it so much, and this is such a good segue into it. My favorite theory is that it's related to rabies, actually. And one of the symptoms of rabies is neurological issues. And one of those issues can actually be hypersexuality.
So vampires, just by their nature, kind of adopted that the symptoms of rabies through popular mythology, or what's the implication?
So the implication there is that as a way to explain rabies in, throughout history, vampires filled that gap. That was the mythology that explained, oh, you know, these people are sick. They're vampires. That's what's causing this. Not they got bit by a bat or a wolf that happened to have rabies at some point before.
Well, I think it's much more exciting to say that they're vampires. Who cares about people with rabies?
I mean, the worst part about rabies is that there's actually no cure. If you have rabies, you will die, and it's not a good death to die.
I think that's kind of an interesting thing to think about in a historical context, because you look at vampires now that kind of symbolize like humanity's repressed sexuality, right? Like vampires are the way that human beings actually are, that we hide from society and we pretend that we're not sexual creatures, or at least this is kind of what's been built into vampire mythology. But to think about all of that coming from possibly from rabies victims just being a little bit more horny with foam in their mouths.
Yeah, well, and that's like another one of the crazy, I don't know if it's a coincidence. It's certainly one of the reasons that rabies came about as a theory to explain vampires. You said it, the frothing at the mouth, that froth can be bloody. So It can look like, you know, you just were drinking blood. You also, and this is weird and also true, if you have rabies, you're much more likely to bite someone. People with rabies apparently get really bitey, which, you know, fits right in with that that vampire mythology as well. The other weird part is rabies can also give you a sensitivity to light and garlic, which those things are starting to seem like more than just a coincidence, right?
Yeah. No, that's really interesting for sure. Yeah, like I think that it makes sense that a lot of those things would come from somewhere, right? Like garlic seems like a random weakness for a monster to have, unless there's some sort of basis for that somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. With that being said, I think that's kind of at least a good place for us to get to at this point in the conversation, is to say that there are some basis for the things in vampire mythology that we accept as fiction, that we accept as mythology, that actually do have some basis in science when you understand that they have a rabial, I don't know, that's a word, a rabies connection to them. That's really interesting. It can be transmitted from bats. Hypothetically, a bat could turn you into a quote unquote vampire with rabies. You could become sensitive to garlic and sunlight.
Yeah. And on top of that, there's also, you know, again, going back to those neurological issues, it can alter your sleep patterns, and you could become nocturnal, essentially, sleep during the day, awake at night, which, again, vampire, like that's got vampire written all over it.
Is there anything about rabies that would necessitate that when you go to sleep at night, it has to be in a coffin?
You wouldn't have to be in a coffin, but that's definitely an option.
So do you think that facet of vampires, like this whole idea of sleeping in coffins, is that just more from the sense of these vampires historically in folklore have just been risen corpses? And so that's just a way to symbolize their dead nature?
I believe that that's correct. There are you know, folklore tales that have no basis in science. Not to say that they're 100% false, but that, you know, it's the old adage of, you know, a story being passed down generation to generation. It's not always as reliable and trustworthy a source as we might wish, but there are stories of people being buried alive, especially in you know, the Middle Ages, where healthcare wasn't the best. Doctoring was just, you know, the guy that lived nearby who kind of knew some things about herbs. And so people, you know, would be unconscious and be buried and then wake up in their coffin and potentially scratch at the top of their coffin, leaving finger marks there, or make enough noise that somebody would come investigate. Again, probably never happened, but definitely contributed to the vampire folklore.
For sure. So let's talk about some of the things then. So we know the things that have some basis in science, or at least in a version of science, if we look at vampires from a different perspective. Let's talk about some of the other things that at least from my perspective, seem like they would be a little bit harder to justify. And those are some of the physical transformations that modern vampires go through when they are turned. One of those, like we mentioned a little bit ago, and we didn't linger on too long, was the idea of like this inhuman beauty. When you become a vampire, you become a more beautiful version of yourself. Before plastic surgery existed, how would this have been accomplished, Chris?
So there actually is, with folkloric vampires, there is a route to inhuman beauty, although we might not look at it as such today. And it goes back to the bloating corpse theory. If you think about what a peasant might have looked like in, say, the 900s, you automatically get a picture in your head, or at least I do, of someone who was malnourished and skinny because, you know, life was pretty hard in 900. Well, if you took that person and let them die and then waited a couple of days, the decomposition process would start to inflate their bodies, and could potentially, if you dug them up at just the right time, could potentially make them look like they were no longer malnourished and make them look like, you know, they were healthier before they died, or much healthier than when before they died. So that's one potential route for science to say, you know, they looked better as a vampire. As far as living people looking better, makeup, I guess. I don't know.
I just want to say, Chris, that might be the hottest take on vampires that I've ever heard in my entire life, is to say that corpses looked more attractive than living people.
I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't say for sure, but I mean, it kind of makes sense if you think about it.
On behalf of whoever my ancestors are, I'm highly, highly offended by this statement. I will say that does make sense. I think that even though it seems a little bit ridiculous just kind of talking about it here, I think there is something to that for sure. I mean, these are people that, like you said, would be malnourished. They would barely be eating. They'd be working all day long. They wouldn't be much to look at.
Yeah, exactly.
At least by modern standards, I should
say. Sure. Well, and you know, that's not to say that there weren't well-fed and beautiful people in, 900 AD, but hey.
Exactly. Another facet of these, then, where we're talking about physical transformations, we talked about being bitten by bats. One facet of some vampires, which I believe is the case in the Dracula novel, is that Dracula has the ability to transform himself into a bat. Obviously, there is some mythological basis for human to animal transformation, not even just in vampire mythology, but just kind of in mythology in general. But as far as vampires specifically go, is there anything to that?
Not that I could find directly. I couldn't really find much about vampires transforming into bats in folklore. I'm sure there are stories out there that I just wasn't able to dig up, but I wasn't able to find any direct confirmation of that.
I think the good thing about that one is kind of like I said, there's enough basis of humans transforming into animals or deities transforming into animals and things like that in mythology of other cultures that I think it's kind of an easy jump if you think that a vampire might have turned somebody into, or I should say a bat might have turned somebody into a vampire. It's kind of a short jump when you're making up a fantastical tale to say that it can work the other way.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And if we're being honest, who hasn't wished they could fly at some point in their lives, right?
That's true. I've never wished that I was a bat specifically, but I have wished that I could fly.
Well, different strokes for different folks.
Let's talk about one last physical transformation that I think everyone is dying to understand how it works. And that is from the mythology of Twilight. When they are bitten and they go out in the sun, they sparkle like they're covered in diamonds, Chris.
Yeah.
Where do the body diamonds come from?
I believe, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they come from diamond mines in Africa.
I hope not.
Well, I mean, we all hope not, but I mean, it kind of makes sense if you make the logical conclusion, blood diamonds, vampires.
So they went to Africa, studded themselves, but only... they only show during the day.
Well, I don't know if they had to go to Africa to do it, but yeah.
All right. Well, that's reaching.
hey, that's the working theory, all right?
Some of the other things, specific things, just kind of going along off of some of the things that we've talked about, some things in more ridiculous things about vampires that I found in modern times. So one of the famous vampires recently is Anne Rice's vampires, started in Interview with the Vampire. Mm. Now, there's some things about vampires in, we'll just base it off the movie since we're talking, that I don't understand. Like, what would compel a vampire to want to tell some random journalist his entire story? Is there anything in mythology to support that compulsion?
As far as I know, there is not. Although that does seem to have sparked a vein. I recently watched a documentary with some vampires that were living together in New Zealand that I thought was pretty interesting.
Yes, that's right. So, but I think that even that, if we want to just kind of jump off some of the other things we've been talking about, like some of these people obviously had massive egos. Like Vlad the Impaler, you don't kind of behave like that if you're not really full of yourself. I'm sure that if that guy had had journalists around at the time, he would have never stopped talking.
Oh, for sure. Like guaranteed that guy. I mean, that's why we're still talking about him to this day. And it was, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Exactly. So I think that there is something to that. Like if you have these fantastical things about you, there's probably a compulsion within all of us. Well, we already have a compulsion to talk about ourselves all the time. So it's a short stretch. There's another thing in that goes with the immortality angle, right? So in that movie, Brad Pitt hooks up with like a 14-year-old chick, but she's not actually, well, she's 14 when they bit her, but because she gets older, technically, she's older than she looks. At what point in vampire mythology does that stop weirding me out?
Well, I can't speak to you, but me personally, I think the answer is never.
What is it about vampires that, again, kind of going back to what we were talking about them representing this kind of repressed part of our nature, it seems like we allow vampires to get away with more and celebrate them for getting away with more than we would in other contexts. Like, for instance, we're fine with Louis hooking up with a 14-year-old vampire, but in Lolita, we're disgusted by it. But it's basically the same thing.
I think really that actually stems kind of from, you know, where vampires come from. If you think about vampires coming from a place where people are, and this is still true today, but I feel like it was more so then, people are confused and scared by death and decomposition of corpses and, you know, what might be out there. Vampires kind of start making sense when you look at them through that lens. And then it's a pretty natural stretch, I feel like, to get from, you know, trying to explain these things you don't understand through mythology, and then, you know, going from there to almost celebrating the things that vampires can do because humans can't, right? Like, because people, society doesn't allow us to do those things.
So with that being said, the last thing I want to talk about before we sign off for today is one facet of vampires that I feel like is pretty universal, even if it's handled in different ways. And that's the inherent evil of vampires. Now, obviously, some vampires have consciousness enough to kind of impede their own desires, right? So, like, for instance, in Interview with the Vampire, Louis prefers to feed off of animal blood so he doesn't have to kill humans. Or like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel has a soul, so he's like a good vampire. But as soon as he loses his soul, he becomes evil again. Would you say that this is all rooted in that same stuff we were talking about before, in the rabies and in the Vlads and all that, or where does that come from?
I think it is, and I think it's kind of the tension between, at least for, you know, European history, I think that's the tension between these folklore beliefs of vampires and the religious beliefs of Christianity at the time. You know, those were in tension with these, all of these folklore beliefs, right? A lot of the superstitions that existed at those times and today were in almost direct conflict with what the church was saying existed, and yet people still believed those things. So I think, especially for something like a vampire, I think it's only natural that that immediately gets that evil connotation, because on one hand, you know, it's maybe somebody who's undead. On the other hand, it's something that the church definitely would frown upon and consider probably demonology, you know, like the, it's definitely got an evil connotation, or it easily gains an evil connotation when viewed through that lens.
So it's, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? We've got so many things that, that pop up because of Catholic repression, right? Like that's a pretty common theme throughout human history. But to think about it is like saying when you deprive a human of their soul, that the body or the mind is inherently evil, right? Like it's the soul that keeps us human. And if you deprive it, we're nothing but animals.
I feel like I just listened to a sermon.
Hallelujah. Bouncing off of that, I have one more thing I actually wanted to talk about, so forget what I said before. Let's talk about killing vampires, because this is a very disputed thing. The most common practice, the one that you will see highlighted in Dracula, is you got to stake them through the heart and you've got to cut their head off. What the hell's going on with that?
So I think the stake through the heart actually has some historical backing, right? That was a common method to dispatch a corpse that you believed was a vampire, and it served a couple of purposes. Again, going back to decomposition, those gases from decomposition get trapped in your body, and a stake can actually release those trapped gases. And it can do a couple of weird things. It can actually vibrate your vocal cords, so it can make it make a sound. It sounds like a could make a sound like a groan, right? So you've got this dead body, you stake through the heart, and it speaks. You know, it's going to freak you out. There's also evidence that those gases, when a dead body is staked, can escape through the anus and make a fart.
And that's popular among vampires, you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if I were to get staked through the heart, I probably would fart as well.
Where does the cutting off the head thing come from? What's that about?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure where the removal of the head comes from. I know that there are other methods as well that have been used throughout history, like burning the body and mixing the ashes with salt, or there's a lot of different folk remedies for a vampire or a corpse that's suspected of being a vampire. But I'm not sure where the beheading comes in.
And the burning thing, I mean, that has Catholicism written all over it, right?
I mean, yeah, it definitely does. But if you're talking about, you want to make sure that something is gone, I can't think of a better way than turning it into dust, right? Like that's the best way you could possibly be sure. Like, I know that pile of ashes is not coming back to life.
Okay, well, let's go back then. Let's go from point A to point F. In Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you've got to stake them through the heart, but when you do, they turn into dust. No burning required. Oh, how does that work?
That sounds much, much more clean and handy than having to stake them and then burn them. I mean, that just seems like a pain.
It absolutely is. So, where's the science in that? Like, if you stake somebody hard enough, would they explode into dust?
So, yes, I will say almost certainly yes. If you stake someone hard enough, they will turn into, I would say, plasma, a hot ball of gas. But the stake would have to be probably moving at a good fraction of the speed of light.
Well, it is in the hand of the Slayer, the one chosen vampire killer.
So you never know.
There you go. All right, awesome. Well, that's all I have to say about vampires. Are there any tidbits that you collected that you didn't get to share?
I will. There is one thing that I feel like any vampire studier would be angry if I didn't bring up. And that is, there's actually a disease that occurs in people. It's called porphyria. And porphyria is... I think it was in the 80s, there was a guy who put forth a theory that explained vampires, because it's another disease where you have a sensitivity to light. It's caused by a lack of heme, which is a protein in your blood. What happens in one case is... your genes that produce that protein are, they're bad. You have bad heme genes. And, so your body can't produce it. And that's what causes all these symptoms. And it also can cause, neurological symptoms. It can also cause, a lot of bad stuff. But nowadays, one of the treatments that they can use is by, injecting heme from another person into your bloodstream. The theory in the 80s was that if you had this disease and you were living in history before it was a known disease, you might be more likely to consume blood. And if you were consuming a lot of blood, some of the heme might be absorbed through your stomach into your bloodstream and actually like help cure this disease. It turns out that is absolutely not how porphyria works at all. It doesn't. There's been no evidence that it creates a drive for drinking blood, and there's no evidence that if you drink blood, heme can survive your stomach. So that the guy who wrote that theory actually essentially withdrew it after speaking to actual doctors, and it still lives on to this day because, people heard it and just latched onto it.
Right. When you first introduced it, just kind of bouncing off of the Vlad story you told earlier, I just assumed it was a fear of poor people.
Well, that is something that, some people, not naming any names, struggle with. and it is real.
All right. Well, as one of those poor people, I will happily represent us. With that being said, I think that I think we learned a lot about vampires today. I hope that you audience learn something about vampires. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next episode.